to Hotel the Blues here on 90.3 CKUT FM. To get tonight's program started off, we're going to turn to the king and perhaps one of my favorite kings of the blues scene. Here he is, Freddie King, playing his number, I'd Rather Be Blind. Welcome back. For those of you who are just tuning in mid-track, that was Freddie King, my favorite king of the blues kings, playing his number, I'd Rather Be Blind. You're tuned in to 90.3 CKUT FM, broadcasting from a small wee little house nestled on the side of Montreal's Mont Royal on unceded Mohawk territory. The program you're tuned into right now is Hotel the Blues, where I, your host, Vishwa Ramakrishnan, play for you some of my favorite blues hits, associates, and affiliates. Tonight, we've got a killer show stacked up for you, all kinds of blues for your listening pleasures during this COVID times. And now, for something entirely different, we're going to go jump way, way back to 1928 to a famous blues musician whom you may or may not have heard. But if you haven't heard of this chap, do check out his other recordings, because I'm sure you're going to hear that his banjo guitar sound, which I don't think is on this track that we're going to play for you right now, is quite funky stuff. This fella I'm talking about is by the name of Papa Charlie Jackson. Now, he was one of the first, and I think the first, blues musicians to record solo. That is, without any accompaniment, just he himself and his strings and just singing his heart out. So he's a really, really pivotal figure and quite an important figure in the early blues, in the country blues scene, way, way back. But to give you a bit of a sampler, you know, a little bit of a taste of his repertoire, so you can go and get inspired and check out some of his other stuff on your own, here's a number from way back in 1928 titled Lexington, Kentucky Blues by Papa Charlie Jackson. Hope you dig. Here on 90.3 CKUT FM.
Down to Kentucky just to play the fowl. Went down to Kentucky just to play the fowl. It's a mighty fine place, you all ought to go there. Thought I'm gonna leave my baby, leaving her all alone. Thought I'ma leave my baby, leaving her all alone. Then my baby cried out, Papa, come back and let me hear you moan. Thought I went to see the horse they call Man o' War. I went to see Man o' War, the horse that had it lead. Say my baby says it's fast, but he really haven't got my speed. I stopped by Miss O'Neill down on Limestone Street. I stopped by Miss O'Neill down on Limestone Street. He's a mighty fine man, had a pile of people for me to meet. Went by Mr. Wright. The president of the fell. Went by Mr. Wright's photo, the president of the fell. He's a mighty fine man, he's always on the swell. Went out to the racetrack, races hadn't started yet. Went out to the racetrack, races hadn't started yet. Someone said the track is sloppy, boys, and I swear it was well. Stop by Mr. Steve Lee, across from the Jackson Hall. Stop by Mr. Steve Lee, across from the Jackson Hall. Got a letter from my baby, she loved me, beat me, and it ain't all star. When I leave Kentucky, I know I really can live. When I leave Kentucky, I know I really can live. I'm coming back to my baby, but I'll have the Lexington, Kentucky blues.
What? And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We have a great show for you today. We're starting a little bit late. Love that blues music that was there. So sorry if you were enjoying that blues music. But Ecolibrium is in this time slot after all. So we're going to use this time slot. We'll be with you until noon on CKUT 90.3 FM. So our show, Ecolibrium, is an environmental radio show covering, you know, environmental issues, all kinds of environmental issues. And sometimes we define environment in a pretty broad way so that we can play all kinds of stuff, you know, be it interviews or lectures or panel discussions or whatever the case is. So the topic of today's show is an interesting one. Just recently, Dave Foreman passed away, and Dave Foreman was the recognized founder of Earth First, And he, I guess, is one of the original people behind what would be called, I guess, radical environmentalism or direct action environmentalism, which is, you know, sometimes a sort of situation where people screw things up on purpose, you know, to basically stop the ongoing attempt to, for example, clear cut a forest or open up a mine or dam some river or whatever it may be, but using monkey wrenching as a kind of strategy to slow these things down or stop them. And essentially, he co-authored, I believe, a book called Eco Defense, A Field Guide to Monkey Wrenching. And that was, he shared the editing credits with Bill Haywood. And there was also the Earth First Journal that was out for a long time as well. So, you know, it's important to recognize the contributions that David Foreman made, or Dave Foreman made, as a founder of Earth First and a prominent member of the radical environmentalism movement. He just recently died on September 19th. I'm not sure how he passed away, but we're going to look into it here on the show and find out as much as we can and let you know. So stay tuned here on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And if I was going to play a song to kind of, I guess, I don't know, start off a show about radical environmentalism and Dave Foreman, I guess I might play, I don't know, something like Blow the Bridge Down. What was they were sisters kind of group, and they wrote about Clackwood Sound. I remember them from years ago. I think it's called Farewell to Clackwood Sound. That's right. And they were called the Weird Sisters, but Weird Sisters as in WYRD Sisters. So let's see if we can locate that song, and we'll start off our show with that. All right. This is Farewell to Clackwood Sound by the Weird Sisters.
On Vancouver Island, for so old, the last of her kind, she is mighty and bold, but the big blades now are mowing her down. Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. Well, the NDP had made a big noise, trying to play the big games with all the big boys. So they sold out her soul for hardly a cent. The raw timber's cut, and elsewhere is sent. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Well, upwards of thousands have stood in the way, but bullies just come and take them each day. And the government too has its own saws. They're changing the charges by changing the laws. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of backward sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Live in the trees, and what of the life, the quiet, the breeze, and what of our planet when she's stripped to the ground? Farewell, farewell to clackwork sound. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of clackwork sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of backward sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Blow the bridge down, friends. Blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of backward sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. When she's stripped to the ground, farewell, farewell to Clackwell Sound.
And that was Farewell to Clackwell Sound by the Weird Sisters, or the Word Sisters. Not sure how to pronounce that because it's W-Y-R-D. But that's a good song about direct action environmentalism, or at least, capturing the spirit of it all. So today on Equilibrium, we are remembering Dave Foreman, who was best known for co-founding Earth First. But he also co-founded the Wildlands Project, the Rewilding Institute, and the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. He was also a board member of the Sierra Club and the New Mexico chapter of the Nature Conservancy. He was the author of several books, including Confessions of an Eco-Warrior and Rewilding North America, A Vision for Conservation in the 21st Century. But he's probably best remembered for Eco-Defense, A Guide to Monkey Wrenching. So this is an actual guide to, how to paralyze a bulldozer, or in the night, or how to spike trees so that logging companies think twice about logging a forest. And so in his early life he was very committed to that kind of direct action, and then later on he became more, I guess, of a mainstream conservationist when he founded groups like, or co-founded groups like, the Wildlands Project and the Rewilding Institute. I know from hearing him in an interview that he claimed to be a manic depressive, or a person who suffered from depression, and that for him, getting involved in protecting nature was what saved his life, because he didn't feel like maybe the future was so bright for him, because he felt self-destructive. And apparently he died after some sort of a lung illness for several months, but there is no kind of cause of death listed. But he died apparently at home peacefully on September 19th, just last week, and he was 74. So that's what New Mexico-based Rewilding Institute has on their website. So I thought today we would play at least one of his talks, a talk that he gave at the Bioneers conference. So they have a conference every year. I'm pretty sure they still do it. And he gave a speech at the 2000 Bioneers National Conference. So that's quite some time ago, 22 years ago. But I think it's a good reflection of Dave Foreman and who he was. And so we're going to play that talk now. All right. So this is his talk at the 2000 Bioneers National Conference. Dave Foreman, the original founder of the radical environmental group Earth First.
I want to talk today about is a central reality of our time, which is extinction. That is the main thing going on in the world today. Since a dodo became extinct on an island in the Indian Ocean in the 1600s, we have seen dozens of species of birds and mammals disappear, even more insects, plants, reptiles, and fish. We are living in an age of mass extinction. In the 1800s, the most abundant bird on Earth was a passenger pigeon. It ranged in flocks of over a billion. In 1803, John James Audubon sat on the banks of a river in Kentucky, and for 3 days and three nights, the sky was dark from one horizon to the other as a single flock of passenger pigeons flew overhead. These passenger pigeons would roost in areas 100 miles long and 20 miles wide, billions of birds in one place, and they were mercilessly exploited, slaughtered for the meat trade in the cities. By the 1890, there were no more flocks of passenger pigeons. The most abundant bird on Earth became extinct in 1914 when Martha, the last passenger pigeon, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. Now, we know from studying the fossil record that in the 500 million years since animals evolved, that there have been five great extinction events. And we have carefully identified these extinction events through the fossil record. The last one was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs became extinct because of a massive comet hitting Earth somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. But in the 1960s, biologists began to compare notes from all over the world. Spotted cats like the ocelot were fast disappearing. Reptiles like the desert tortoise, having their habitat destroyed and being run over by dirt bikes, were also becoming endangered. We passed the Endangered Species Act to try to stem this tide of extinction. But it soon became obvious that we were not just seeing the loss of a few beautiful species like the ocelot and some wonderful little critters like the desert tortoise. But in fact, we were in the middle of the sixth great extinction, the Pleistocene-Holocene event. And leading biologists like E.O. Wilson predicted that we could lose up to one-third of all species in the next 50 or 100 years. This is the central reality of our time. And we cannot blame an asteroid for causing this extinction. It has one and only one cause, and that is 6 billion human beings breeding, eating, manufacturing, warring, traveling. We have become a plague of extraterrestrial proportions on the Earth, and we are causing the extinction of many of our fellow travelers, our closest relatives, the primates, and many other species around the world. There are five leading causes of extinction today. One is the direct persecution and killing of animals, such as the campaign we waged in the middle of the last century to wipe out all wolves in the United States, the mass slaughter and poisoning of prairie dogs. This kind of direct exploitation has been a leading cause of extinction. Another major cause of extinction is the invasion of exotic species, like the bullfrog into southwestern streams, eating up Chiricahua leopard frogs and native fish. Disease is another major cause of extinction, bringing in exotic diseases through humans, pets, and domestic animals. The black-footed ferret was nearly wiped out by distemper. And then pollution. Industrial activities of all kinds are now making a major threat to the survival of many species. But the leading cause of extinction is habitat destruction through agriculture, overgrazing, logging, and other destruction of habitat. And a key part of habitat destruction is fragmentation of the landscape. Fragmentation, breaking the land up in smaller pieces, leads to direct threats to many species. Something like a freeway is very difficult for even the wily e. coyote to get across. This chart is the area species curve. And I know it doesn't look like a curve to you, it doesn't look like one to me. But what it is, it's a graph where the vertical axis is the number of species of reptiles and amphibians, and the horizontal axis is the size of islands in the Caribbean. And as you can see, there is a direct relationship between the size of the island and the number of species it holds. This is the area species relationship. And its corollary is that if you destroy habitat, you will lose species. In fact, if you destroy 90% of the habitat, it has been shown that you will lose 50% of the species that inhabit it. So as we break up habitat in smaller and smaller pieces, we see species decline. If A is an area of forest, and the white part is the interior forest habitat that many songbirds depend on, and the dotted area around it is the edge effect, we see that when you have a big block of forest, you still have a lot of interior forest habitat. But if we keep the exact same amount of forest but break it up into four pieces, we suddenly lose most of the interior forest. If we break it up even further, that interior forest disappears. The careful scientific research, we have determined that even Yellowstone National Park is not big enough in and of itself to maintain viable populations of wide-ranging species, like grizzly bears, wolverines, or wolves. This is particularly important because we have recently learned through research in the tropics and the oceans and temperate areas just how important large carnivores are. Now, we know that large carnivores are important because if you protect enough habitat for a healthy population of wolves, you're going to protect habitat for many other species as well. But ecology has been showing in recent years the importance of top-down regulation of ecosystems. Jim Estes looked at sea otters on the Pacific coast, or rather at the absence of sea otters. When sea otters are present, there are healthy kelp forests. But when sea otters disappear, the kelp forests also disappear because the sea otter's main prey, the sea urchin, is a voracious predator on kelp forest. You remove the sea otters, there's a population explosion of sea urchins, and they destroy the kelp forest and the hundreds of species that depend on the kelp forest. In suburban San Diego, Michael Soule has looked at what happens as suburbs surround remaining patches of coastal sage scrub and canyons. As long as coyotes are present in these little canyons surrounded by suburbs, all the native birds are there. As soon as the coyotes disappear, though, the native birds disappear. Why? Because any smart house cat, like my beautiful cat Chama, knows to stay home when there are coyotes about. You remove the coyotes and the house cats, the foxes, the skunks, the possums become more bold and go into these remaining habitats and eat songbirds. We've seen how the reintroduction of elk in Yellowstone has entirely changed the behavior of elk. in Yellowstone National Park. No longer are elk loafing around meadows overgrazing. But with the wolves there, the elk are suddenly elk again. They're looking over their shoulder. They're running around. They aren't loafing. And the land is much healthier for it. On Isle Royale National Park in Superior Lake, we see that when there's a healthy population of wolves, they maintain a healthy population of moose, which means that the balsam fir forest is healthy. But if we remove the wolves or have a low population of wolves, the moose overpopulate with dire consequences for the forest. These are called trophic cascades. In the eastern United States, we've known for a long time that neotropical migrant songbirds, the warblers and thrushes that go south in the winter and breed in the eastern United States and Canada in the summer, their populations are declining. Part of it is destruction of their habitat. But David Wilkove has shown that a major part of it is mountain lions and wolves. Not because mountain lions and wolves eat baby songbirds. I mean, no self-respecting mountain lion is going to skulk about in the forest looking for warbler eggs to suck. I mean, some things just aren't done in nature. I mean, a mountain lion going after baby warblers would be like John Wayne having gotten a nipple ring. Some things simply do not happen in nature. The problem is that in the eastern forest, there are no longer any mountain lions or wolves, which means meso-predator release. Raccoons, who don't have the self-respect not to suck warbler eggs, suddenly become more abundant and act more boldly in the absence of their predators. And they, and skunks, and foxes, go into the forest and eat baby warblers. John Terborg, the dean of tropical ecology, has been studying what happens when you remove jaguars from tropical ecosystems. A huge reservoir in Venezuela created a number of islands. On those islands, too small to support populations of jaguars and harpy eagles. The forest, which once had 60 species of trees in it, now only 5 species of trees are reproducing. The reason is because in the absence of their predators, leaf-eating monkeys and other things have become unnaturally abundant, and they have changed the entire composition of the forest. So all over the world, we are finding that when we remove large carnivores, the whole system begins to unravel. Now, this doesn't say that all ecosystems are regulated from the top down, or top down is not the only thing going on. There's all kinds of other influences, but we are finding in every study done so far that when large carnivores are removed from an ecosystem, it has dire results. Now, large carnivores need big core habitats, and they need connectivity between them. In the United States, we simply don't have large enough areas anymore that are wild to maintain habitat for large populations of jaguars or wolves. And so we need to link them together so that individuals can disperse out. And all it takes is every 10 years for a horny adolescent male mountain lion to go between one population and the other to keep them connected. So this leads to the idea of rewilding, that for healthy ecosystems, we need the presence of large core areas, we need linkages between those core areas, and we need the presence of keystone species and processes like large carnivores. But how do we get there? How do we achieve this? This is what the Wildlands Project is about. And our sister magazine, Wild Earth, and we have a booth over there, and I'll be talking more about this in the workshop this afternoon, directly how we might create large core areas and link them and reintroduce large carnivores to get healthy landscapes back. Places like the Sky Islands Wildlands Network on the U.S.-Mexico border, tying together the big wilderness areas like the Gila Wilderness down through corridors of the Pelencillo Mountains to the Sierra Madre in Mexico. And let me just mention here one direct thing the Wildlands Project has been doing. Jaguars, thick-billed parrots are all native to to New Mexico and Arizona, but they were driven south of the border 100 years ago. If we are going to have jaguars and thick-billed parrots back in the mountains of New Mexico and Arizona, we have to protect their habitat in northern Mexico. And here's Peter Warshaw and Diana Hadley trying to explore their habitat. It took us 2 hours to get out of here. So we're in really rough country. The thick-billed parrot is down to just a few hundred breeding birds. Their closest breeding habitat is only 40 miles south of the U.S. border. Peter and Diana and I have stood and watched thick-billed parrots while seeing the Chiricahua Mountains in Arizona on the horizon. Last winter, the Wildlands Project, Naturalia, and our other partners in Mexico signed a groundbreaking deal with an ejido, a Mexican land-grant commune, to protect the largest remaining thick-billed breeding area left in the Sierra Madre, a 6,000-acre patch of old-growth forest. By paying them the value of the forest, they are not going to log it. And we are going to work together to develop ecotourism so birdwatchers can go in and see the thick-billed parrots and others, so the local folks can make the money off it. And we hope to show that protecting nature, protecting the thick-billed parrot, brings more money in the long run than a one-time liquidation of that old-growth forest does. We have a breeding population of jaguars 100 miles south of the Arizona border. The ranches there will sell for $15 an acre. We are trying to raise the money now to be able to buy those ranches, hire local people. And all of this is done through a Mexican land trust, by the way. It's not gringos coming in and doing it. We're just trying to provide the money so that jaguars will be able to once again freely disperse into Arizona, New Mexico, and we may once again have a breeding population of jaguars in the Gila Wilderness or the Blue Range or the Chiricahuas in Arizona and New Mexico. This is a way to really do things. And what it shows is that we have to look across borders. We have to look across the borders of public land and private land. We have to look across the borders of the United States and Mexico. We have to look across the fragmentation and the conservation movement of some people protecting species, other people protecting land, other people working on economic incentives. And we have to bring it all together so that there is a single coordinated effort breaking down barriers, looking across borders, and trying to rewild nature in North America so that human civilization and society can once again begin to coexist with the wild, with the will d'or, the self-willed animal, with the will d'urness, which means self-willed land. And that's fundamentally the challenge of our times. Do we have the generosity of spirit and the greatness of heart to allow some land to have a will of its own? To have some wildlife with a will of its own, where we are not dominating and controlling and manipulating everything, where some things are beyond the control of human civilization, and we celebrate that. And that is the other great value of large carnivores. I forgot to mention prairie dog towns in Mexico, but we're trying to protect them too. But the great value to the human spirit of large carnivores is that it teaches humility. And goodness only knows that in the modern world, humility is the virtue in shortest supply. We are surrounded everywhere by human arrogance, and there is nothing like comparing your tracks to a grizzly bear's tracks to bring you humility, to teach you humility, to show us that we are not gods upon the planet, that we are not lords of all that we survey. But rather, in Aldo Leopold's words, we are plain members and citizens of the land community. What we want to do is become the kind of people, the humble kind of people, who can protect self-willed nature, who can defend its right to exist for its own sake. And all of us have to stand up, just like those brave folks with Headwaters Forest, just like to stand up and defend the land like my friends in Alabama defending the last big old growth forest in Alabama, all of us together working to save untouched nature and to rewild the landscape as well. That is our challenge. And our challenge is to never see this again. We feel mighty, we feel arrogant, we feel like gods when we bring the wildeor through, when we lynch the self-willed animal, when we impose our will on once self-willed land. This is the kind of thing we have to work against so we never see this again. This parading of the mighty grizzly bear through the streets to show how powerful we are. We need to find humility from images like this and reach inside of ourselves and become better people. Nobody, I think, has thought more about this humility, has thought more about our relationship with wild lands, with self-willed lands and self-willed animals than Aldo Leopold, who died over 50 years ago. In 1909, Aldo Leopold caught a train after graduating from Yale University with a master's in forestry and took the train all the way west to the territory of Arizona. Arizona was not yet a state. And he went to work for the newly created Forest Service in eastern Arizona in the White Mountains, Blue Range, Mogollon Rim country, which at that time was a vast wilderness without roads. Leopold's first job for the Forest Service was to cruise timber. And he'd go into the wilderness on horseback for 2 weeks at a time with a crew of men counting trees. Forest Service couldn't log those trees because there were no roads, but they wanted to know what was there. But on one of those trips, Leopold and his men were about a week into the wilderness. They had stopped for lunch on a rocky little rim rock overlooking a rushing stream below. And they sat there and ate their greasy sandwiches of biscuits and bacon. And they saw a doe ford the stream below them. At least they thought it was a doe at first because of her long legs. But when a bunch of wolf pups came running out of the willows on the other side of the stream to greet their mother, Leopold realized that it was an old mama wolf they were seeing. Well, in those days, any wolf you saw was a wolf you shot. And Leopold and his men ran to their horses, pulled the 30-30s out of the scabbards, and began to blast away downhill at the wolves. Well, if you hunt, like I do, you know it's hard to aim downhill. But a lot of lead went down the hill that day. An old mama wolf crumpled. One of the pups dragged her shattered legs back in the willows to die a slow death. Leopold and his men mounted up and rode down the hill to skin out the varmints and pack their hides back to Springerville to sell. But something happened to Aldo Leopold that day in 1909. And he wrote decades later, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and I've known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to the wolf and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch, because fewer wolves meant more deer. I believed no wolves would mean a hunter's paradise. But after watching the green fire die, I realized that neither wolf nor mountain agreed with such a view." Aldo Leopold helped exterminate wild wolves in the Southwest. They've been gone since 1935. But a few years ago, wild Mexican wolves were reintroduced into eastern Arizona. And after looking over the map, I realized that by pure serendipity, those first wolves were released only a mile from where Aldo Leopold shot the green fire wolf. That we have come full circle to be able to welcome the wildeor back into our hearts. And so join with me. Join with me in celebrating the rewilding of the continent. the return of the wolf, of the jaguar, and the return of the wild in the human heart. Thank you.
And that was a talk by Dave Foreman called The Rewilding of the World. And Dave Foreman just passed away September 19th. He died peacefully at his home in Albuquerque. And he was best known for co-founding Earth First, but he also co-founded the Wildlands Project, the Rewilding Institute, and the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And he served as a board member for the Sierra Club and the New Mexico chapter of the Nature Conservancy. And that speech was from the 2000 Bioneers National Conference. If you are interested in finding out more about the Rewilding Institute, you can find them easily by looking for rewilding.org. So that's rewilding.org. We're going to take a quick break for a little bit of music and ads or messages. And here's a rare gem. This is the Raging Grannies. They came out with an album. I guess it was a collection of different Raging Grannies stuff from all over North America, including Montreal. So it's worth checking out. But this one comes from, I guess, a group of Raging Grannies in Seattle. And it's called Radical Environmentalist. And, of course, that's the label that Dave Foreman had for much of his life. So here is that song now.
Oh, we're radical environmentalists. We're radical environmentalists. We like clean air and clean water, just like the farmer's daughter. We're radical environmentalists. Oh, we like our veggies without pesticides, and our meat without those hormones placed inside. We like fish without PCBs, and forests that still have some trees. We're radical environmentalists. We like automobiles that do not pollute, and we like guns that simply cannot shoot. We like lawns grown without weed and feed. We don't like that gene splice seed. We're radical environmentalists. So join these radical environmentalists who want wind power and electric cars. Recycle all your glass and paper, and you can tell your maker you're a radical environmentalist.
Cinema Politica Concordia is thrilled to invite you to the long-awaited launch of our fall 2022 season. Join us on October 3rd for a special screening of the award-winning film The Territory, a collaborative and deeply committed film about Indigenous land defenders protecting their traditional territory against encroaching deforestation brought by farmers and illegal settlers. Through dramatic landscapes and Indigenous filmed witness footage, The Territory highlights the global nature of Indigenous struggle for land and climate justice. On October 3rd, 7 p.m., room H110, Concordia's Hall Building, 1455 de Maisonneuve West. Venue is wheelchair accessible, donations kindly encouraged. CinemaPolitica.org or find us on social media. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Le 3 octobre, ce sera jour d'élection générale au Québec. Pour savoir où voter et pour connaître... Le 3 octobre, ce sera jour d'élection générale au Québec. Pour savoir où voter et pour connaître la liste des candidats qui se présentent dans votre circonscription, consultez la carte de rappel jaune que vous avez reçue par la poste ou visitez notre site Web. Pour voter, vous devrez présenter une pièce d'identité. Les bureaux de vote seront ouverts de 9h30 à 20h. Pour plus d'informations, consultez le www.élections.québec ou communiquez avec nous au 1-888-ÉLECTIONS. Le 3 octobre, on inverse la tendance. Tout le monde vote. Un message d'Élections Québec.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
I soar above the clouds, moving like lightning, smiling, cheering. The midnight neon beckons me underground. The black swan glides, glittering, gleaming feathers of fluff, like a giant powder puff settles down, head held high. Venus is my love. Venus is my darker and darker, the pictures demented scream obscenity. Bewitched, bemused, the fossils follow. Excited crowds as one they holler. I see a monster sleeping, creeping, arms akimbo, like a flying Makimba. I encountered my hero's eyes, I blushed. Venus is my love.
It's part of a way of life. This life between agony and ecstasy. So love is for the very young.
Deeper and deeper, darker and darker. I feel the needs must be to fly. The black swan smiles, glittering, gleaming. Feathers are sleek and snaring all it seeks. Languidly glides into the night.
Wow.
And that was Peter Straker. Peter Straker, who maybe you don't know him that well, he's a British guy or British artist, but originally from Jamaica, and did a lot of theater, musical theater as well. But some years ago, he put out that song, The Black Swan, and that was actually co-produced with his friend, Freddie Mercury. Freddie Mercury was one of his best pals, and Freddie Mercury actually, like I said, co-produced that tune called The Black Swan. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're out of time, so thanks for listening to the show, and we'll be here again next Tuesday, same time, 11 a.m. till noon, bringing you news and information about the environment, about environmental issues, etc., and always playing good music, because, you know, we have impeccable taste in music. What can I say? You know, lots of environmentalists do, I think. It's because they listen to a lot of birdsong. Maybe that's just my theory. You can always follow us, our show, on Facebook at facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUTMontreal. We post things there from time to time. We have an affiliated podcast on Spotify called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast, but you can also check it out by going to equilibrium.pod.